Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 305, recorded Monday, July 10th, 2017. Tony Rome. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen rate and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage just for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. And by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super simple Wi-Fi system. And now, the second generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping, visit Eero.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter code TRIANGULATION. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk to and about the most interesting people and things going on in technology today. I am very excited to welcome Tony Rome. He is an editor. He's the senior editor of policy and politics at Recode. And so if you're one of those people who feel that politics should be on one side and technology should be on the other side and never the twain shall meet, keep listening. Because hopefully we will change your mind. It's like the people before they discovered the, Reese's peanut butter cup. Like, oh, chocolate and peanut butter, they're separate. But I think they taste great together. And I think that more people in technology should be talking about politics and more people in politics should be talking about technology. And that's where Tony comes in. All of his beat is the intersection of technology and politics. He's written for Politico. He's worked for The Hill. Thank you so much for joining us, Tony.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with Trump on Twitter. Just over the weekend, in the span of 12 hours, I think, Trump tweeted that there was going to be a cybersecurity unit. He discussed one with Putin. And then I think 12 hours later, he said that there wouldn't be one anymore. It wouldn't work. It'd be great if they could, but it wouldn't work. What do you think this kind of back and forth is causing to political discourse right now?
Well, I think this actually starts with the G20 meeting that just concluded in Germany a few days ago. You know, the President Trump met with his counterpart in Russia, President Vladimir Putin, and the two discussed a wide range of issues. And one of the things coming out of that was this question as to whether this White House pressed Putin enough on the allegations of hacking that disrupted the 2016 presidential election. You know, there are plenty of folks in the U.S. intelligence community that have produced a number of reports that say Russia did, in fact, have great influence over the U.S. election. But there were fears that Trump wouldn't go far enough in pressing Putin on this and exiting the meeting. Folks had said the same. But the cybersecurity tweet you're talking about is this notion on Trump's part that perhaps the U.S. and Russia could have worked together on some sort of group that could tackle cyber threats facing elections in the U.S. and in Russia and other places. And security experts just pounced on that. They noted the fact that many of these attacks have come from Russia, and putting both, you know, countries on the same panel would only serve to create additional security threats for U.S. elections. Plenty of folks in the U.S. Congress criticized the president. And then you saw the follow-up tweet just a day or so ago. The days all run together at this point. I believe it was yesterday where Trump said that this wouldn't, in fact, work. I wouldn't expect to see some sort of U.S.-Russia election-focused cyber panel coming together anytime soon.
Do you think there is any way to secure the elections, or are we just screwed?
Well, there are definitely ways to secure the elections. There are lots of conversations that have to happen, you know, and there have long been concerns that states in particular, and remember that states have the biggest roles to play when it comes to administering elections, that they don't have the talent, they don't have the expertise, they don't have the technical expertise to deal with some of these emerging cyber threats. I mean, it's hard enough for power plants and hospitals and other major U.S. institutions and forms of critical infrastructure to safeguard against major major cyber threats, and election systems are another example of that. So there's definitely more to be done. Whether that's going to happen with Russia sitting at the same table is another question entirely.
I know right before the election, there was a lot of talk about, like, is voting secure? Are ballots secure? And then really, I mean, what we saw was it wasn't just like someone going in and, you know, stealing a bunch of ballots or anything like that. It was just a social media campaign, just so much misinformation and chaos. And so do you see any way to prevent that in further elections?
Yeah, misinformation is the big issue. Facebook did a whole study of this shortly after the 2016 election. And while they didn't put out a great deal of data, they did say that information operations, as they put it, were pretty notable on the site. And they had to go after fake profiles and accounts that were peddling facts that just completely were false. And so you've seen a number of companies, whether it's Facebook or Google or Twitter, start to ask the question as to what role they should play in ferreting out fake news. It's the expression that everybody hates because it's become so polarized. But this notion that social networks have some gatekeeping function here to stop the spread of blatantly false information. That being said, when you get into those conversations, you're then asking the question, what role should tech companies play in moderating speech? You know, what role should they play in controlling the kinds of things they can share, the kinds of things that users share on their platforms? And a lot of folks are still pretty uncomfortable about giving a Facebook or a Google too great influence in determining, you know, the kinds of political news that appear on those sites. You know, we had a huge crisis around this with Facebook just a few months ago. Facebook took a lot of heat when it tried to tweak its trending news section. That's that box that appears at the very top corner of folks' news feeds. Some of the folks who were looking through stories to determine what was going to appear in that trending section were accused of having exhibited conservative bias, that they were removing right-leaning news sites and news stories from that box. And, you know, at the end of the day, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg had to sit down with some of the leaders of these conservative news sites and assure them that they weren't doing anything to, you know, exhibit bias against them, that they weren't trying to censor Republican viewpoints. So in instances where these companies have taken action to have some sort of filter on the information that folks are sharing on there, they've taken great heat, but there is a great demand right now and potentially a great need for them to serve some sort of gatekeeping function. That's sort of the big debate I think we're going to have as we get into the 2018 midterms and in elections after that.
Well, I think that trending news is a good example because I think probably Facebook knew that it could come out, it could spin out of control pretty easily if you just let it go. And we saw that last week on Twitter with the CNN meme that Donald Trump posted, and then the New York Times found the person who made the meme and then did not mention the person's name and then wrote sort of an awkward addendum to the piece saying we agreed to release his name if he continued to post memes. And so then there was the hashtag on Twitter, the CNN blackmail, and that became the story, right? I mean, for many people who wanted it to be the story, that hashtag CNN blackmail, whereas CNN didn't blackmail them, the person. It was obvious in the facts, but that was what was trending. And so what do you do then? I mean, is it Twitter's responsibility to step in at that point?
I mean, there are multiple threads here, right? I think first and foremost, the story did become the way CNN managed to find this individual who had posted the GIF of the president tackling somebody from a wrestling match with the CNN logo on it. And it wasn't just that he had put this GIF up on Reddit. It was that he had a history of saying very racist, misogynist things on the website. And other reporters had found that and had started writing the fact that the president had tweeted a GIF that had come from somebody who was spewing this sort of hate. CNN, I think there are a couple threads here. The first is that regardless of the issue, I think there's a long conversation to be had around policing abuse on a site like Twitter. And Twitter in particular has faced plenty of criticism for not doing enough to stop abuse on the service, whether we're talking about, you know, folks who are harassing female journalists to instances in which individual users are threatening reporters, threatening to put their addresses of their families and so forth on the site so that they can be further harassed. That sort of happened in this case with CNN. It wasn't on Twitter, but you know, the journalists did field a number of threats to themselves and to their families as a result of the things that they put together. So there is certainly a lot to be done to deal with these issues of abuse that have really come to the foreground as a result of a very, very vicious, dangerous, in terms of rhetoric, presidential election that just wrapped up in November. I think the second issue, though, with CNN is that a lot of people are waking up to political news, and there is a role for journalists to play in explaining their methodology. I think CNN itself probably recognizes that it could have explained why it phrased things and presented them the way it did. But you know, that shouldn't take away from the bigger conversation here, which is that there is a lot of abuse and misinformation on some of these platforms, and we're kind of getting close to this reckoning on what exactly to do about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, because I believe in free speech. I mean, I don't want to give any Wonder Woman spoilers here, but I feel that, you know, it was a good example. I, you know, she just said, like, it's like these people don't necessarily deserve, like, the Nazis and, you know, people attacking journalists. They don't deserve the free speech, but it's not about deserve. It's about what you believe, right? And as Wonder Woman says, I believe in love. So have you not seen Wonder Woman, Tony?
I have seen Wonder Woman.
Okay.
It's actually a movie I've seen for a change.
Okay. So let's talk about CNN. You brought up CNN. That's a good example of another way that technology is really overlapping in politics in terms of antitrust. I know that that Trump has used to work with the head of CNN. And that was, you know, on NBC, and now they had a relationship, and that's part of why many people think that he is sort of going after CNN. But he also has some power in the AT&T Time Warner deal. Can you talk a little bit about that and what kind of influence he might have in terms of whether that goes through or not?
Yeah, so let's start at the beginning. AT&T announced its plans to buy Time Warner. It's a huge antitrust review by the U.S. government. Customarily, deals of this size have to be reviewed by the Justice Department and sometimes by other agencies to ensure that they're good for competition and they're good for consumers. So AT&T announced this transaction. Trump ultimately won the White House, and that raised a number of red flags for the company because Trump, as a candidate, had repeatedly criticized AT&T and its plans to purchase Time Warner, part of a larger campaign on Trump's part to go after what he saw as media conglomerates. He focused a lot of his criticism at companies like Comcast as well. You know, from the beginning, it looks like part of Trump's criticism of the deal had to do with the fact that Time Warner owns CNN, and CNN has covered Trump incredibly critically, as we just talked about with respect to this tweet. But even in the decisions that he's made with the folks he's appointed to key government positions, to his policy proposals on areas like immigration and so forth. And so at the time, there had been questions as to how a Trump White House would deal with this and the kinds of individuals it would appoint to key government positions that oversee the deal. In the end, Trump ultimately nominated someone by the name of Maykin Del Rahim, who is a well-known corporate antitrust lawyer, to lead the Justice Department's antitrust division. Del Rahim hasn't been confirmed by the full U.S. Senate, but in the months before he had been nominated for that post, he had actually said some positive things about the AT&T deal. He didn't think it would pose a major antitrust concern. So in the eyes of some competition experts, they looked at that as a good sign that maybe Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail was going to stay that way. It was just going to be pure rhetoric on his part. Then we saw the report in the New York Times just the last week that suggested Trump could use CNN as, quote, leverage in an attempt to kind of shake up this deal if AT&T and Time Warner want to proceed without any sort of conditions on their merger or they don't want to face any trouble, that maybe Trump would kind of dangle CNN in front of them. Now, the White House hasn't said anything of this sort. But it still managed to rile a lot of critics up who really felt that Trump might be intervening in a process that's supposed to be independent. And so on Friday, one of the leading lawmakers in the U.S. Senate, Senator Amy Klobuchar, the top competition lawmaker in that chamber, wrote a note to the Justice Department saying, you know, hey, you guys got to detail your conversations with the White House. We need to be sure this is independent because there are free speech implications. At the end of the day, I think what's going to happen is that Attorney General Jeff Sessions is going to assure her that no communication communications had been exchanged between the two, and probably the AT&T and Time Warner deal will go forward uninhibited. That's been the belief for a long time, that this merger is just going to go through. And some of what we've seen in the past few weeks will just continue to be pure political spectacle.
But this isn't the first time that Trump sort of talked about antitrust issues with technology companies. I mean, he had on the campaign trail, and even after he was elected, he's had some things to say about Amazon. And what do you think? Do you think that he would have any effect on the Amazon purchase of Whole Foods?
This is the big question right now. These processes are supposed to be insulated from politics. You know, when the Justice Department or the Federal Trade Commission or the Federal Communications Commission looks at a deal of this sort, they're supposed to do it in this bubble away from whatever's happening in national politics. And so the president's not really supposed to be involved in this stuff at all. Like, should not be talking to the Justice Department about a merger review of this sort. So the concern is that this administration maybe doesn't appreciate those boundaries between the agencies and the White House, maybe doesn't appreciate the need for independence, and could begin to exert influence on the process. And that's especially the case with Amazon, because the president was so critical of the company and its CEO, Jeff Bezos, throughout the 2016 campaign and even into his presidency. I mean, at one point, Trump threatened that Amazon would have, quote, problems if he were elected president. And then he was elected president, specifically because of antitrust. And for Trump, there again, the issue has been media. Bezos individually owns the Washington Post, and the Post, much like CNN, has been incredibly critical of this presidency. It's reported doggedly about allegations of the Trump administration's potential ties to Russia. So, you know, we've continued to see this back and forth between this administration and Amazon. Trump even went after the company again just a few weeks ago related to some of the coverage that was in the Washington Post that he found to be fake news. It's just important to point out, Amazon's a company doesn't own the Washington Post. It's Bezos individually. But Trump has consistently linked the two. And now this kind of hovers over Amazon's merger with Whole Foods. But at the end of the day, folks are optimistic that this deal will be reviewed by the government and won't have the sort of interference that Trump has threatened in the past.
So aside from the Washington Post, Trump has said that Jeff Bezos is a huge antitrust problem. Do you think that Amazon itself, now that they're moving into so many different areas, do you think that they pose an antitrust problem?
Well, that's the big question right now in D.C. And it's not even just does Amazon pose an antitrust problem. It's do U.S. antitrust laws, do U.S. competition laws have the right teeth to deal with a company like Amazon that may or may not have monopolies in multiple industries? I mean, this is sort of diminishing it, but looking at the Amazon Whole Foods deal, there are a lot of folks that would argue it's a vertical merger, which means Amazon and Whole Foods are, you know, gobbling each other up, and Amazon and Whole Foods don't currently compete in that market. So Amazon's just expanding upwards as opposed to expanding outwards and taking a competitor out of an industry in which it's already operating. You know, does that really work in the digital age? That's the big question right now. And there were a lot of Democrats, folks like Senator Elizabeth Warren, that were really agonizing for a stronger antitrust approach to companies like Amazon and Apple and Google and some others. They really want the U.S. government to go after them, but there's no indication that the Trump White House or really any Republican administration has the interest in sinking their teeth in these companies and really trying to extract some major concessions from them as a result of their mergers.
Well, I want to talk about net neutrality, which you are an expert in, and I have so many other topics to talk about, too. But first, I want to take just a minute to thank our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. If you're in charge of hiring someone, you know how frustrating it can be, how time-consuming. You're already missing an employee, and now you have to spend the time finding one. ZipRecruiter makes this process a lot easier. It's throwing technology at a problem, which is what we always love to do because we're geeks. So you need to hire someone. Try ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter will let you find all the best candidates. You can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. It's powerful technology. It's efficient. It matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. All you have to do is screen, rate, and manage the candidates all in one place. You can do it on your couch if you want, with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes. If it's just you, you can use ZipRecruiter. If you have a giant business, it also works. You can find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, just for you listening to this interview, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, I said free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. That's ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit, and we thank ZipRecruiter for their support. Net neutrality is back in the news this week. Talk a little bit about what's happening with the net neutrality day that is being planned by some companies this week.
Yeah, it's the Net Neutrality Day of Action, and it's scheduled for Wednesday. So we find ourselves in this place because FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, a Republican, is trying to undo the work during the Obama administration to subject internet providers to very strong utility-like regulation in order to protect net neutrality. Pai has a much different approach in mind, and he thinks that what Democrats did is a little too heavy-handed. But tech companies and consumer advocates really prefer the Obama administration's approach. And to that end, they're launching something of a protest on Wednesday. Some of the biggest companies like Amazon, Facebook, Google, Twitter, Snapchat, and others plan to rile their users in any way they can to get them to sound off with the FCC and the hope that maybe the FCC is going to change its mind and might reverse course and not pursue Pai's plan. Now, let's be real, that's not going to happen. Pai, a Republican, has a Republican majority at the FCC, and for a very long time, he's promised he was going to undo the Obama administration's rules. But I think the plan on the part of the tech industry now is to show that net neutrality is a popular issue in the hopes that maybe someday Congress might get involved and might deal with this issue once and for all with a more lasting legislative solution.
So you did a great interview with Ajit Pai. I mean, before I listened to your interview, it was, you know, he's really been painted as this evil villain that's coming in, you know, to destroy net neutrality. And he had a lot of good points. Of course, he's the FCC chairman, so we would hope that he would be able to communicate well, which he did. But I mean, he brought up a lot of points about how a lot of people in the press are saying, like, he's getting rid of these laws that we've appreciated for so long, but really it's only been since 2015. And, you know, what those people against those people for net neutrality are really talking about internet fast lanes and talking about something that hasn't come to pass yet and might not. What do you say to that?
Well, that was sort of part of the point. You know, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler felt that there was a need to have bright line rules on the government's rule books that said what companies could and couldn't do, fearing that if it were the Wild West, that you would see a world in which companies might charge for online fast and slow lanes, as folks put it. But Pai felt that the mechanism that the government used was too heavy-handed. Really, what we're talking about here is a fight over the exact portion of law that we're using to address net neutrality. With Wheeler, he took internet and broadband providers and began to treat them as telecom services under a portion of law known as Title II. It's pretty wonky, but you'll hear the word Title II thrown around a lot in this debate, which essentially subjects these broadband providers to old school telephone regulations. And the FCC went out of its way to exempt them from some of the most onerous regulations, like rules that might allow the FCC to regulate the rates that they charge consumers. But Republicans in the telecom industry really just saw it as a down payment on even greater regulation of the internet community, that it would lead the FCC under perhaps different Democratic hands to start to try to regulate internet service providers even more than they currently do. But, you know, we find ourselves in this place because we've gone through multiple iterations of court battles over what authority the government really has to address net neutrality. And we're already looking at a potential court challenge with whatever Pai ultimately adopts at the end of this debate. We're still a while away from the actual end of this debate. But when Pai has a plan, it will probably land in the hands of a court. And that's why we're having all these conversations about Congress. Somebody probably has to issue a final lasting solution. Otherwise, we're going to keep talking about protests and FCC rulemakings and wonky things of the sorts for many years to come.
I mean, do you think, you know, I'm not saying it's never, it's always good to protest and show what you believe and stand out there, I believe. But, I mean, they already have the votes. I mean, do you think that there is any chance that, Ajit Pai is going to change his mind? I mean, are we just expecting, like, the same thing that happened to with Tom Wheeler, that, like, John Oliver and all the, you know, regular people can change another FCC chairman's mind?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, Michael Beckerman, who's the leader of the Internet Association, a lobbying group that represents the likes of Facebook and Google and Twitter, he said the same thing. You know, there's no reason not to raise your voice. It would be like showing up expecting the game to, you know, change course without you having any sort of effect on it. Like, you have to raise your voice, especially because I think these folks recognize that if they can build strong political support and build a broad enough base of supporters, that it might help them in a coming battle in Congress, or it might help them in a coming legal battle, as they point to the popularity of this program. Whether or not that's effective, another conversation entirely, but that's at least their thinking. Whether it sways Pai is another question, because Pai has made it clear since 2015 that he didn't want to reclassify broadband providers. He didn't want to use Title II for net neutrality. And while he served as a commissioner at the agency at the time, he voted against it. So did his fellow Republican, Commissioner Michael O'Reilly, who's still there. And the third, soon to be nominated and confirmed Republican, Brendan Carr, believes the same. He's worked for Ajit Pai. The votes are already there to take down Title II. Now, what Pai ultimately replaces it with is something that remains to be seen. That's the process we're working through now. But Title II is gone. There's no reason they're going to keep it. This has been the signature thing for Pai and Republicans. And, you know, it's while it's important to get folks' voices heard at the FCC, there's only so much I think they're going to be able to do at this stage of the debate.
So during your interview with Pai, I noticed he kept bringing up broadband in rural areas, increasing broadband. That was something that he feels strongly about. And I know you've written about that in the past as well. What does this have to do with net neutrality?
Well, Pai's argument is that having heavy-handed government regulation deters companies from investing in some of these rural areas. You know, if you aren't looking to invest right now because you're afraid it's going to cost you too much, you're just going to skip it entirely. And the first place you're going to look to, you know, cut back, you're going to be rural areas, because you're going to serve fewer people, and the cost of serving those areas is going to be much higher just to begin with, because we're talking about people who are spread far and wide. We're talking about rough terrain. You know, those areas aren't wired for a reason. And it's because it's very difficult to do. So Pai seems to think that if you lessen some of the regulatory burdens, you might eventually incentivize companies to show up and start building in these places. The flip side of that, however, is that that's not entirely the case. Some of the reason these companies don't build there is because the money just doesn't look good for them. They need additional incentive other than regulation, whether it's government spending or something else entirely. So, you know, rural is a piece of it in Pai's mind, but it's not the entire picture here.
And so, I mean, in the past, like during the Obama administration, there was a lot of, you know, there was maybe what Pai would call heavy-handed involvement trying to get internet access into rural areas. But I know that you wrote that there was a lot of that didn't work either. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the story of the Obama administration's work on broadband has to do with the economic recession, actually. You know, the administration put forward the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which many folks know is the stimulus, in an attempt to kind of kickstart the U.S. economy at this time when there was massive joblessness and, you know, fears of even greater economic hardship in the country. And a piece of that included about $7 billion to spur broadband investment across the country. A good chunk of that money went to a program at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a very, very little-known agency called the Rural Utility Service, that spent a few billion dollars to try to improve internet access, particularly in the hardest-to-reach rural areas. We're talking about, you know, very mountainous places, the most secluded farms, things of the sort that are very far from population centers, where it's prohibitively expensive sometimes for internet providers to dig up the ground to put in lines and sustain their service for years to come. come. It depends on who you ask, however, whether this program was effective. There are some folks who believe that some of the money went to projects that needed it, that some of these broadband networks they invested in ended up serving their communities quite well. The Commerce Department did its own bucket of work as part of the stimulus, and a lot of those networks are still up and running and serving communities around the country. The other side of that is that the Rural Utility Service struggled immensely to get its dollars out in time. A lot of the networks had significant trouble. They defaulted in federal loan payments. The money didn't go back to the U.S. government in the way that it should have, because many of these were loans that were made in the most higher-risk areas. But the issue there, I think it's important to remember, and I try to convey in the story, is that it's not that government spending is wrong with respect to broadband. It's that the way the government spent, on the timeline in which it spent it, at this particular agency that had a history of mismanagement, was a serious trouble that they faced at the time. So, you know, I think the takeaway going forward here is that as this Congress looks to spur broadband internet adoption, if it finds the bandwidth to do that, given all the other things that are happening right now, that it's got to find a creative, effective way to put up those dollars and actually see some tangible improvements in the country's rural areas.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's one thing to talk about, yes, everyone should have broadband access. I mean, this has been a problem since the Clinton administration. You know, you talk about that too. And but that was a utility. And now we're talking about, you know, just the digital divide, just the fact that it's necessary for students to have internet access in order to learn these days. And it's getting more and more, and it's just going to get harder and harder. So, I mean, do you see Ajit Pai or the administration being able to help this in the next 4 years?
It's really hard to answer that, because the digital divide concerns so many different discrete things. Sometimes it's rural to urban, cities having better access than, you know, the hardest to reach parts of the country. Sometimes we're talking about socioeconomic issues, where the cost of broadband, the cost of some of these packages is way too high for most consumers to afford. Sometimes we're talking about issues of race and redlining in communities where companies aren't doing enough to serve in, you know, housing developments that aren't wired with the most up-to-date connections. There are lots of individual things that have to be tackled. I think I'm a bit of a pessimist when it comes to Congress and the administration tackling this in the short term, because the costs of doing it are immensely high. And I mean both in terms of the amount of money that has to be spent and also the time. You know, Congress hasn't done a whole lot on telecom policy in the better part of the past few years. You know, it's really in fits and starts that they really do manage to invest in those networks and to invest in those communities. And there's nothing that suggests that Congress is suddenly going to get a little bit of a kick in its step and, you know, do these things that have been left on the sidelines for a long time. This administration, meanwhile, has said it wants to begin to close some of those digital gaps, whether it's dealing with rural areas or releasing more of that invisible wireless spectrum that powers your smartphone. But repeatedly, I've asked the White House for details about what those plans really are. And even in the days after President Trump traveled to Iowa and promised during a major speech that he wanted to improve internet access, they had no plan. They had nothing yet to show for exactly what that would look like. So there isn't anything to suggest that, you know, we should expect some immediate gigantic improvement in broadband access, because there isn't anything that suggests that Congress or the White House has some new magical plan that might fix that in the short term.
And so what do you think, what role do places like Facebook, or, I mean, I know Facebook is more concerned with getting broadband outside of the U.S. into, you know, areas all over the world. But what role do you think companies like Facebook or Apple or Google, what role do you think they can play in getting internet access to places, you know, or getting devices, if that's what we're talking about with the inner city? What role do you think they have to play in?
I mean, Google tried. Google Fiber was Google's attempt to kind of kick the rest of the telecom industry into gear while offering a service of its own that Google thought was superior. But Google encountered some of the same problems that long-term telecom providers did. It ended up proving prohibitively expensive for them to wire networks in some of these locales. It was very difficult for them to get the permits and the other regulatory permissions they needed to set up shop at a number of cities in the United States. So Google tried, but Google encountered some of the same roadblocks that other companies have. The problem that Google and Facebook and some of these other tech giants face, though, is that every time they look to offer broadband, especially in other countries, it really just reads like an attempt for them to improve their balance sheets by getting the next billion online, so to speak. That's what happened with Facebook in places like India as it tried to launch internet.org. It really felt to folks on the ground there that it was just Facebook's attempt to expand its business and its brand to another country, to another group of people who weren't yet online, and not some altruistic thing to address the digital divide. I'll leave it to others to parse what Facebook's exact motivations are, but that's certainly a challenge they face, the perception that they're just swooping in, particularly in other countries, not just in the United States.
So in terms of net neutrality, someone who was thinking about it this week, like, do I want to do something? They've gone to their favorite website, Amazon, Netflix. And I mean, what would you tell them that they're really, I mean, what are people really fighting for if they want to keep net neutrality?
Well, on the surface, these companies are trying to get folks to sound off at the FCC, which is accepting public comment on Chairman Pai's initial plans for net neutrality until July 17th. That's just the first window here. There's still much more to come, but they really want to help build a record at the agency right now of folks who support net neutrality. And I believe at the moment there are about 5 million comments that have come into the FCC, which is a bit of a record, but not all of them are supportive of net neutrality. There are a good number of them that want to overturn the Obama administration's work. In the long term, though, I think the hope on the part of tech companies is to really shake up the debate in Congress. As this thing continues to go back and forth, Democrat and Republican FCC, and in and out of the court system, there's a recognition that really only with one new long-lasting law can we put the net neutrality debate to rest. And probably the only way that that really gets on the radars of folks on Capitol Hill is if they hear a lot about it from their constituents, if it feels to them like a major national political issue or one that might affect them. That's a pretty tall order. That's not going to be easy to do. Things like healthcare, rightly, are the kinds of things that members of Congress are fighting over right now, not the wonky, you know, ins and outs of telecom policy. But I think the hope is that if, you know, tech companies can generate pressure and folks reach out to their members of Congress, that it, sooner or later, maybe, you know, Capitol Hill will do something about it.
Well, on the subject of the responsibility of tech companies, there's been a lot of overlap, more than I've really seen in the past since Trump was elected, just of tech leaders being involved in politics. And, you know, he has all the tech leaders coming to D.C. for these meetings that you covered. And I wonder, so you wrote recently about Eric Schmidt and Elon Musk, who both speak against a lot of what Trump says, but then they're also backing some Republican campaigns. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, the tech industry has matured a lot over the better part of the past 8 years. You know, I've covered this beat for about that long, and what was once an industry that was very reluctant to play in politics has recognized that it has no choice but to play in politics, that tech titans that maybe don't like Washington and maybe don't like lobbying or donating to federal office holders have to do those things if they, you know, want their agenda addressed in D.C. or if they want to spare themselves from government scrutiny. And so you find yourselves in the place that we see today where, you know, someone like Eric Schmidt, who is a very, very well-known Democrat, has aided Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, provided similar support to Hillary Clinton during the 2016 election, is also trying to branch out and build those relationships with Republicans, because it's Republicans who are in charge in Washington, D.C. right now. They control both houses of Congress and they control the White House, obviously. And I think that with the tech industry sits a little differently than with other industries. You know, I don't think anyone bats an eyelash when someone in the banking community or the energy sector contributes to a Democrat or a Republican that happens to help their bottom line. But the engineers in Silicon Valley tend to react very negatively when they see their executives backing folks for very cynical political reasons. You know, it doesn't really sit well with a lot of them, and they protest when they find out that Schmidt or Google or another executive or another company is trying to play both sides, trying to make friends in both parties, because they just don't see it as necessary. They see it as a bit of a compromise. So, you know, I think as we get into the 2018 midterms, we'll have a lot more of these instances where folks like Musk from from SpaceX and Tesla and Schmidt at Google are going to have to explain why they're giving to both parties, even though it makes a lot of political sense for them to give to both parties. It just may not sit well with some of their employees back home.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like the whole tech industry is coming to a little bit of a reckoning. I mean, you know, back when the internet started, it was this utopia. We're going to start over. We're going to be a meritocracy. We're going to accept people of all kinds, women, men, you know, any. And that doesn't seem to have worked so well. So in a lot of areas, it just, you know, it turns out like tech is not so much of a meritocracy. And there has been a lot of, you know, sexism and racism in tech companies. And so it does seem like there's a bit of reckoning all over the place. And I am glad to see these tech giants getting more involved in politics. But it does, you know, when you reported on the technology week that Trump had, and you did a great just what everyone wants. And basically, they, you know, Tim Cook was there, you know, and he wanted, like, let's talk about what all these leaders wanted when they were there. Let's start with Tim Cook. What did he want out of his discussions with Trump?
Yeah, so Tim Cook, very publicly sitting just next to Trump at the final concluding session of his Monday visit to the White House in June, specifically asked the president to support computer science education. He wanted to make computer science a requirement in public schools across the country. You know, Jeff Bezos, sitting just like pretty close to Trump as well, said that he wanted the president to make it easier for him and other companies to sell commercial technology to the federal government. That's important. Important for an Amazon or some of the others in attendance, because Amazon sells lots of stuff to the federal government and wants to sell more of its Amazon Web Services business to federal agencies and make lots of cash money as a result of it. The folks like Satya Nadella and others have pressed the president for a long time on fixing immigration. That's probably one thing that unites everybody sitting in that room, is this belief that the U.S. government has to preserve and expand its high-skilled immigration programs. The president, as is probably very obvious, has taken a bit of a hardline stance on immigration. And with high-skilled immigration, he sent some pretty mixed signals as to what he thinks should happen to programs like the H-1B visa. At the table, though, he pledged to work with the tech industry to help them get those foreign workers that they would like. Plenty of others there want to fix government procurement, and they want to improve cybersecurity, and they want to address things like allowing more drones to fly in U.S. skies. And these are all things that the tech industry has sought for a long time in DC, not just because they see it as this, you know, wonderful way to revolutionize government and improve citizen services, but also because they sell some of that stuff. They have a lot to gain personally from a world and a government in which is a little bit more permissive with the way they can do business.
It makes me think of what you were saying about Facebook, how, you know, everyone just assumed they were trying to just give the world Facebook by going into India. And it's the same thing. I mean, I want more education, more technology education. I want changes in the current immigration policy. But I mean, how do these tech companies get around the fact that everyone, you know, that what helps their bottom line might also be good for society?
Well, I mean, a lot of companies and a lot of industries lobby for what's good for them. And executives do the same exact thing. That's not unique to the tech industry. And in fact, I think if you talk to folks in the tech industry, they get a little upset that they're held to this double standard that, you know, the CEO of Bank of America or Goldman Sachs isn't held to. No, like, nobody's going after the banking industry and the financial services industry and complaining that they aren't doing enough to you know, help their, you know, help other parts of the country. I think they sort of just expect that those companies are going to do what's best for them. So the tech industry asks the same question: why can't they do what's best for their own bottom lines? But I think the difference is the marketing. You know, the tech industry spends so much time trying to tell everybody that it's changing the world and it's improving the United States and improving the daily lives of you and I that you know, to do that and then play a very cynical lobbying game in DC doesn't read consistently to some folks out in Silicon Valley and the Bay Area. So they end up taking a lot more heat than I think other companies would.
That's true. Well, I want to ask you if you think Mark Zuckerberg is running for president. So I'm going to prepare. I'm going to let you think about that and take a second.
Oh, that's easy. No, the answer is no.
Okay. Okay. Well, think about why or why not. I know I'm not supposed to ask yes or no questions. But first, I want to take a second to thank our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. If you've ever gotten a mortgage to refinance your home, or I assume you got a mortgage when you bought that home you want to refinance, it's not the best process. It's kind of old fashioned, and you're digging through paperwork. You have to get up off your couch. You have to put actual clothes on and go out into the world. But you don't have to do that with Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage lets you apply for a mortgage simply, and you understand. That's the great thing. You can take the time to understand. I think that mortgages are one of those things that mortgage brokers sometimes, if they just throw a bunch of terms and acronyms at you, they'll confuse you, and then you'll do whatever they want. But Rocket Mortgage does not do that. Rocket Mortgage is simple. You'll understand the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. We live in the digital age. There's no need to go diving through all that paperwork. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's also powerful. So if you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. You can sit there with your iPad or your Pixel phone or whatever and just watch the magic happen to find the right mortgage just for you based on your income, your assets, your credit. Rocket Mortgage analyzes all of the home loan options for which you qualify and then find the right one just for you. So you can concentrate on finding the perfect house just for you, and then they can worry about all the rest of that stuff. It's no wonder J.D. Power and Associates ranked them the highest in customer satisfaction for primary mortgage origination 7 years in a row and mortgage servicing for 3 years in a row. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of triangulation. So you said before the break that Mark Zuckerberg is not running for president. Why do you think he's not running for president?
No one who has said that he is running for president has any evidence that Mark Zuckerberg is running for president. The reason this started was because it looked and felt as though Mark Zuckerberg were running for president based on his appearances around the country, some of the conversations he's had with political officials, and a rather confusing bit of a securities filing that talked about Zuckerberg, you know, serving in some government capacity. Folks took from that a sign that he was running for president, but you know, there's nothing that suggests he is in fact running for president. And until he says it, or until we have any verifiable evidence that he is, I'm going to maintain no, he is not running.
And Sheryl Sandberg, do you think she's running for president?
I think Sheryl Sandberg probably has some political ambitions, but I don't think that she's running for president. I mean, it's also important to remember that like this has huge implications for that, for Facebook as a company. So these things won't happen in a vacuum. But I don't think that she's running for president, and I honestly think it's so early right now. You know, we haven't even recovered from the 2016 election. We still have a midterm election that arguably is just as important as the presidential election. Who knows where those chips will land in a few years, but I think it's more likely you would see Sheryl Sandberg do something in California or in some other capacity, maybe before running for president. We'll see, though. I've been wrong before.
Is Kara Swisher running for president?
You can ask Kara. She'll tell
okay.
you.
Okay. Not yet. Good. I will ask her. I think it's fascinating what Mark Zuckerberg's been doing this year. And it just really shows the influence that Facebook has. I mean, he should do all that. He should go out and meet all those people. He should see what people are, you know, that use his network every day, what they're like, instead of just living in his, you know, walled area. And, you know, I mean, of course, they're going to be the photos that we're looking at now of him doing it, which look very presidential. But I think it makes perfect sense. And I mean, I think that both I think that Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg and arguably Kara Swisher as well, like have some more power in the positions they're in now than they might Yeah, and who would want to be president? I wouldn't. Although no one's asked me. Let's talk about some other leaders who are getting involved in politics. Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn and Mark Pincus of Azinga just started a new political group called Win the Future. And you wrote about that. Tell us a little bit about what their mission is.
Yeah, Win the Future, which, yes, does abbreviate to WTF, is an attempt by Pincus, who's the brains behind Zynga, and Hoffman, who put together LinkedIn, to rethink the Democratic Party. There's a belief on their part, at least, that the Democratic Party is not as open-minded as it should be. It probably isn't recruiting the right candidates for some major offices at the federal and state level, and that its platform probably doesn't reflect some of the views of its own voters and could be more open-minded to attract voters who maybe actually aren't Democrats. So Pincus and Hoffman have put together a website that also serves as a political movement. They want folks to submit ideas for what should be part of the WTF platform, so to speak, and if those ideas get the most votes, measured by tweets and likes and things of the sort, then they'll become part of WTF's official orthodoxy. And if they raise enough money, Pincus and Hoffman want to start putting up billboards with those viewpoints near Washington, D.C. airports so that members of Congress see them as they enter and exit the Capitol. And then going forward, Hoffman and Pincus have started having conversations with potential candidates who could run as what Pincus described as WTF Democrats, people who would run under the banner of their organization. And one of the individuals he's talked to is the frontman of Third Eye Blind, with whom he has a relationship, and could be convinced, perhaps, to run against Dianne Feinstein, who's the senior senator in California. She's a Democrat. There's a lot of frustration, particularly with Pincus, that Democratic leaders just really aren't up to snuff, that they're not listening enough to their constituents. And so he's looked at Feinstein, and he has some pretty pointed criticism of Nancy Pelosi, the Democrats' leader in the House. That's something that comes down the line. But for right now, I think the goal for Pincus and Hoffman and WTF is to really shake stuff up. Whether they can do that remains to be seen. There are a lot of groups that are looking to do similar things on the margins with the Democratic Party, but it's early, and we'll see how it unfolds.
And how does that affect their companies, that bottom line? Because presumably, I mean, is Reid Hoffman, is he still part of LinkedIn, even though they're owned by Microsoft?
Hoffman has a role. I think for Hoffman and for Pincus, they've both been involved in politics for a very long time. You know, in crunching the numbers, I believe Pincus gave somewhere north of about $2 million to candidates over the past few years, and Hoffman is somewhere close to that. They're very, very active in raising money and donating money and providing their services to Democratic candidates. And I think as major donors, they're a little bit frustrated with the direction of the party. And so their hope is to create this platform and let others express their frustrations, since it's a little bit harder for folks who can't give $2 million a shot to express their views and kind of shift the course of a political organization like the Democratic Party. But, you know, they do face an uphill battle, not just because Democrats have their own goals in mind and an entire party structure that's been honed over the course of many, many, many years, but also in selling what they're doing to users who may or may not like the fact that there are very, very wealthy human beings trying to create this populist online movement to shift Democrats. So, you know, it's the same question that faces all of the organizations that have come together after Trump's elections, the so-called resistance. Can they actually make a meaningful, measurable difference in upcoming elections? And Pincus and Hoffman, despite being very, very star-studded, accomplished individuals, face that uphill battle too.
I know that when Trump was elected, a lot of people in politics, a lot of people that were working for Obama and the Obama administration moved in to technology. But we also see we're seeing a little bit of the other way around. You wrote about a former Uber exec, Rafi Krikorian, who is now working for the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, and as their chief technology officer. Do we see a lot of movement from tech companies, like into politics?
Well, at the moment, no, largely because a lot of folks in the tech industry don't want to work for the Trump administration. But separate of government, there are a lot of folks in the tech industry who are putting together these groups that are resisting Trump, or they're at least funding some of these organizations that are trying to resist Trump. That's everything from groups like Tech for Campaigns, which is an organization I profiled earlier this year that had been dispatching engineers at very well-known Silicon Valley companies to local congressional races. They were involved in a special election in Montana, for instance, and that's important because many of these local and state officials don't have a lot of policy expertise or a lot of tech expertise, rather, on staff. They can't afford to have these folks who are digital savants. Sometimes the campaigns themselves are like two or three people large, and the district they're covering are quite small, but there's a belief in Silicon Valley that they too could benefit from better Facebook targeting and better tools, the sorts of which have been available for national campaigns for a long time. So there's definitely an interest in Silicon Valley in taking this pent-up frustration with Trump and doing something productive with it. But to return to, Rafi, who headed over to the DNC, one of the things that he faces as the DNC's new chief technology officer is taking all these disparate things that are kind of working towards the same goal of electing more Democrats or more progressives and bring them into an organization like the Democratic National Committee that has some of its own similar projects, and take all of that and harness it in 2018 in a way that helps Democrats win some more seats. It's a very daunting task for him or for anybody in that role, but it's one that he faces in the coming months.
I mean, is he also going to try to make sure the networks are more secure than they were? I mean,
Yeah, that's the thing. You got to worry about cybersecurity now. Specifically, Tom Perez, who runs the DNC, said he wanted to improve their cybersecurity. And for folks who maybe don't remember, the DNC was definitely targeted by, some email hack. Lots of emails ended up on WikiLeaks, things of the sort. But, it's not just Democrats. Republicans face the same challenges, too. If, there's nothing that suggests that, maybe next time around hackers couldn't target other campaigns or individuals. So really the entire political ecosystem faces a major challenge in securing themselves against potential cyber threats.
Mm-hmm. And not clicking on those links that you think are
And not clicking on phishing links.
I know we brought up the Trump's talks with tech executives. You seem to have a lot of really excellent sources in there. You had your piece up about what happened before anyone else did. What do you think overall was accomplished that week, and what do you think was not accomplished? What do you think that they what were you hoping to see that they might talk about that they didn't?
Well, this was the first time that Trump administration had really gathered folks for a hardcore policy discussion. The president had met with many of the same executives in the room during his transition at Trump Tower, which was billed more as a reconciliation of sorts between the president and an industry that had wildly opposed him throughout the 2016 election. This time around, we had Jared Kushner, who's leading this new Office of American Innovation in the White House, and some other key officials there who are focused on modernizing government, on improving the sorts of websites and other services that the U.S. government offers, to you and I, which is really an issue that's had bipartisan support for a long time. Barack Obama spent many years working on that. Some of the things that Trump is looking to do build off of the work that Obama did on that. So there was a lot of conversation around that. It was really their first sort of conversation around leveraging the private sector to improve the inner workings of government. And it gave some of those execs an ability to raise their voices on issues like immigration and other sorts of things that matter to the tech industry. And then later on in the week, there was a second session with some companies that work in areas like drones and the Internet of Things and other kinds of emerging technology, as well as their investors, to talk about ways the government can help spur those inventions through the work that it's doing and through the legislation it supports on Capitol Hill. If you talk to folks after the fact, what they tell you is that they thought they had a pleasant exchange, that everybody was cordial. There was a lot of learning to be had. There was a lot of interest in the White House and among the White House's senior officials in doing something about it. But, are they optimistic about from where we go from here? Hard to answer, just because there's so many things that have to happen for the Trump administration to bring its ideas into fruition. Just take government procurement, for example. Everybody at that table agreed that the government buys technology in a really, really poor way. And lots of tech companies want to sell more of their technology to the feds. But in fixing government procurement, that's the sort of thing that requires Congress. And now you're talking about a multi-year effort to reform the way the government spends its money. Those are very, very hard things to tackle. So I think a lot of executives walked away from that meeting a little bit hopeful and maybe a little bit surprised at the level of engagement for the White House. But you know, whether that translates into any sort of meaningful reform is the question on all of Silicon Valley's mind.
Can you talk a little bit about Matt Lira? He's who you call the Trump's tech whisperer. Tell us about him.
Yeah, at the time, he was one of the few people in the White House who were working on technology. Now there's a much bigger contingent of folks. It's kind of hard to map out, but Kushner runs what's called the Office of American Innovation, and then which is focused on bringing some big picture solutions to the troubles of government. And then within that, there's an organization called the American Technology Council, which is a collection of federal agency leaders from spaces like the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Commerce who are tackling specific challenges facing the federal government. That's run by an that organization is run by a man named Chris Liddell, who previously was the chief financial officer of Microsoft. Matt Lira works in that orbit as well. One of his specializations is thinking about the way the government uses technology. He's a former staffer from Capitol Hill, who worked for a number of important lawmakers on some of the stuff that is now pending before the Trump White House. And then there's another individual by the name of Michael Kratsios, who is serving as the deputy chief technology officer at the White House. He's a Peter Thiel ally. And remember, Thiel as an investor had been one of the only prominent tech supporters of Trump throughout the election. That being said, there are a number of open science and tech gigs in the White House right now. Here we are in July, and we still do not have a leader of the White House's Office of Science and Technology Policy. We still do not have a chief technology officer. There are a lot of hands that aren't on deck right now that still have to be filled, and there really isn't much of a sign from the Trump administration that this is top of priority given the other stuff that they have to tackle right now.
So is it that they can't find someone that aligns with their beliefs, or they're not really trying? It's just they don't think that it's important to have.
It's a little bit of all of the above. I mean, there's so many positions in government that aren't filled. I think it's important to remember the context there. As a lot of people have written stories about this, they've missed that. It's across the board that there are a lot of positions that aren't filled. National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, big player in the issue around self-driving cars, has nobody at the helm right now. There's no full-time director there. There are open gigs in Health and Human Services and plenty of other agencies in the U.S. government. So it's not just technology. The administration has tried to talk to people about some of these open gigs in the White House, but it hasn't really made a whole lot of progress, and it's really not the top of mind for this administration. It also doesn't help that this president campaigned on reducing the size of government, and so I think you can expect to see a lot of these positions not exist by the end of the Trump presidency. I think the goal is to really cut down on the size of some of these federal agencies in and outside of the White House. So they have a lot of work still to do to staff up this government. And just for the sake of comparison, when Obama took office in 2009, he had already named his Office of Science and Technology Policy Director, Dr. John Holdren. He had worked with Obama on the campaign, had served as one of his advisors, and Obama got there and already had his guy in mind. This administration, the Trump administration, didn't have those kinds of connections during the campaign to the tech industry. So it wasn't really a surprise that when Trump took office, he didn't have these names ready to be nominated. There's just a big gap in terms of readiness because of this administration's relationship with Silicon Valley.
What was there a chief technology officer before Obama? Like, did Bush have a chief technology officer?
Yeah. We've had people at the White House who have had those roles. Obama really gave the chief technology officer a lot more heft. Anish Chopra was his first one, and Anish had a lot of responsibilities. They did a lot of the things that the Trump administration wants to do, whether it's fixing the tech troubles at the Department of Veteran Affairs to addressing issues around broadband access nationwide. Those same things are things that started under Obama that Trump now wants to tackle, which, getting back to your earlier question about whether they'll be effective, there's a reason it took Obama 8 years to make the progress that they made. It's because it's hard stuff. And so the Trump administration faces some hard stuff going forward, too.
Well, I want to also talk about self-driving cars, because that's another way that the technology and politics are going to be interacting in the next few years, as they're going to need regulation. I just want to take a minute first to thank our sponsor, Eero. If you have trouble getting internet access to all of the rural areas of your home, the upstairs, the downstairs, Eero might be a good solution for you. Eero was one of the first mesh networks, and they are really great, and they fit in. They're not the ugly old router that you used to have. They fit in. They look nice in your house, and you can put them in places and get internet access. So you can listen or watch us wherever you are. Let me tell you a little bit about Eero. With Eero, you can easily create and share a guest network. You know how many devices are connected at the given point, and you can check the internet speed that you are getting from your service provider. Eero is protected with state-of-the-art WPA2 encryption, and because it controls the hardware and software for your entire network, it ensures that you're always secure. Traditional routers don't push software updates, so customers are left vulnerable to cyber attacks, and Eero automatically updates so that you will have the latest features and security at all times. Also, Eero has some really great customer support. With Eero, you can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home in just a few minutes. Simply download the Eero app on your iOS or your Android device. It'll walk you through each step of the process. It's quick, easy, and painless. I didn't get a chance to install mine, so my 12-year-old twin boys got frustrated with me, and they decided to install it themselves. So if 12-year-olds can do it, I assure you that you can do it too. Eero is also excited to introduce the second generation Eero and Eero Beacon. They allow you to build a Wi-Fi system that's perfectly tailored to your home than ever before. Both offer more speed and range in the same high-quality, elegant design. With the addition of the third 5 gigahertz radio, the second generation Eero is now a tri-band and twice as fast as its predecessor, letting you do more simultaneously in every room of your house. And with the addition of a new Thread radio, Eero can connect to low-power devices such as your smart lock, your smart doorbell, all your other sensors, and more. Expanding your coverage in any room is easy with Eero Beacon. Simply plug it into the wall and you're covered. If there's an outlet, there is Wi-Fi. For free overnight shipping, visit Eero.com and at checkout, select overnight shipping. Then enter triangulation. That's how you make it free. So, and don't forget to enter triangulation. That way you get free shipping and they know that we sent you. That's Eero.com and enter code triangulation. And we thank Eero for their support of triangulation. All right, so self-driving cars, that's going to be a huge technology over the next 4, 8, 10 years. But it's going to require regulation. And right now it seems like states are doing the regulation, whether they can have cars on the road or not. But tell us a little bit about what you've written about the federal regulations for self-driving cars.
Yeah, you know, the states have really led the way when it comes to self-driving cars. The states have a lot of authority to do that, remember, that they can control who's on the roads to a large degree. And many states have legalized some form, not many states, but a number of states have legalized some form of testing, often with some restrictions, whether it's California or New York. You can't just necessarily plop your self-driving car in a public road and kind of go for it. You know, there are lots of safety concerns. There's definitely interest in Washington, D.C. in thinking about what the future of self-driving cars looks like in the event there is some, you know, much discussed age where none of us has a steering wheel in our cars. But to do that, it's going to require a bit of legislation. And one of the things that House Republicans have looked to do is to start to, you know, tear down some of what they see are barriers to self-driving car adoption. And the sorts of things that they're contemplating are, you know, really manifold. One of the things they want to do is to strip the states of the authority to yes or no self-driving car testing on their roads. I think the federal government should really set one uniform standard across all 50 states. That really hasn't set well with a lot of Democrats who think that the states have safety concerns worth asking or worth addressing. And it's especially the case because there are a number of transportation positions that remain open in the federal government. Going back to the conversation we just had, there's a fear that, you know, if you start to allow self-driving cars in a world in which the U.S. government isn't prepared to allow them, it doesn't have official officials to oversee them, that that could be quite a big issue. There are other bills that have been put up by House Republicans would allow companies to share information about their testing and about some of their incidents with U.S. agencies in a way that keeps that data private. So, you know, pesky reporters like myself can't get a hold of it, which has drawn a little bit of criticism from Democrats as well, because they think that at a time when there's a trust issue around self-driving cars, that perhaps you should make some of that data available so that consumers know exactly what they're getting when they get behind the wheel. Whatever the issue is, though, we're still a long ways away from some sort of overarching federal law on self-driving cars. You know, the things that were presented at a committee hearing just a few weeks ago were really just drafts of bills. That still has to become actual legislation, and then it has to be voted on and sent to the House, and the Senate has to act. So, you know, I don't think that you should expect to see some sort of, you know, national self-driving car law in the better part of the next 6 months. You know, we're talking much longer than that. But there's at least a widespread bipartisan recognition in D.C. that maybe there needs to be some uniform federal rules around autonomous vehicles.
And what about drone regulations? Where are we with those now?
Drone regulations are a little different. The FAA has played a much more hands-on role because of the way that it controls federal airspace. I mean, the most recent thing that happened was that the FAA got in trouble for the way it put together its drone registration database. You know, they were fearful around Christmas time about a year ago that the influx of drones were going to create all kinds of safety and security hazards. So they wanted to create a consumer drone registration system. But in a court challenge, it was found that the FAA kind of broke the law. It didn't really have the authority to create that registration system. And so the agency is now in the process of refunding folks who submitted their drone registrations to the federal government. I believe the amount is about $4 million they collected. So for everybody who sent their $5 into the feds to register their drones, they can get that back now. But there are a lot of questions around drones that still have to be answered on Capitol Hill. You know, while there are limited sites that you can test these things and areas where you can and can't use them and restrictions around airports and stuff, Congress has been chipping away at some of those restrictions with each subsequent bill that authorizes the agency that oversees the government's airspace. So I think that's starting to progress, but it's much further along than self-driving cars are.
If we registered our drone during the time when it was free, would they pay us $5?
I don't think they're going to give you free money.
It's true. A girl can hope. I want to ask you about an organization that I had not heard of, one of tech's watchdogs, you said, Color of Change. Can you tell us a little about what they're doing?
Yeah, Color of Change does more than just technology, to be clear, but they're one of these organizations, sort of liberal in focus, that very much speaks out about civil rights issues. And in the tech industry, they have been particularly vocal around issues of diversity. At times, they have challenged companies that haven't done enough to address the concerns of their African-American users or their employees. And during the course of the 2016 presidential election, they went hard after a number of companies that were thought to be supporting the Republican National Convention. That's the organization and the setting where Donald Trump was officially nominated, the big party that they had in Cleveland. You know, every year companies support that sort of thing, but Color of Change went pretty aggressively after some companies who had supported it in 2012, encouraging them to back out in 2016 because of Trump's comments about minorities and immigrants and women and some others. You know, they really felt that it was the tech industry, you know, saying one thing but then doing another with its dollars. And so Color of Change has kept up a lot of its work. And in recent months, it took a bit of a benefit in terms of a shout out from Hillary Clinton, whose new organization, you know, said that they were going to support Color of Change in its mission. And in my conversation with Rashad Robinson, who runs the organization, he said that you can expect them to be just as aggressive on issues around diversity and inclusion with the tech industry than ever before.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I have so many more questions for you, Tony, but I don't want to take too much more of your time. You write about all of this stuff with such an even hand, which I think is so needed right now, because I think on both sides, people feel really like they're not being heard and that no one's listening to their side. And it's causing just a great rift. You see it on social media and in real life. So I just want to ask you, what is it that keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night? My deadlines.
Okay.
I think it's my editor's deadlines. I think that's an interesting question. I We'll have to save it for the next one. I hadn't really thought about that.
Okay. All right. Save it for the next one. I want to know what keeps you up at night. Also, I want to know, like, if you hadn't spent this last hour with us, what would you be doing? Like, what's your daily reporting process? Like, are you calling up Donald Trump? Are you responding to his tweets? What?
No, I'm not responding to his tweets, although I do get them sent to me on my phone so I can see them in real time as they happen.
All night? You have it on all night?
Yeah, they're on. I mean, it started with the transition. The president at very, very strange hours would attack a company. He would go after Amazon and some others, and so you needed to know if he was going after one of your companies. So I would get it in real time and could act as it came out. Sort of the speed at which things move these days. But I don't think anything I do is particularly unique in terms of daily work. You know, as a journalist, you have to be on the phone harassing people as often and as aggressively as you can. And that's been the case for all of time and will continue to be the case regardless of who's in the White House and what the circumstances or the stakes are.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for joining us. Tony Rome is a senior reporter, editor at Recode. He's at Tony Rome on Twitter. Is there any other place where we can find you?
That's really about it. Recode and Twitter is a good place to start.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I'll hope to talk to you again so you can answer what keeps you up at night. And thanks you for joining us on Triangulation. Triangulation comes on every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific. And we love to have your feedback. We love for you to join us in the chat room. And you can subscribe. If you can't watch live, you can subscribe at twit.tv/try. And you can be the first one to get it. And you can find me on this network Monday through Friday on Tech News Today and occasional Triangulations. And you can find me on Twitter if you have any comments about anything. I'd love to hear from you at Megan Maroney. And thank you so much for listening.